Item number five, North of Falcon Policy, and this is a decision. So I will turn it over to Kyle and Bill Esquire.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Smith, Commissioners, Directors. I'm Kyle Addix with the Fish Program, Intergovernmental Salmon Manager. With me is Bill Freymeyer from the Office of the Attorney General. I think it's actually colder outside than it was when you guys met in December, and they complained about how cold it was in the room. At least it's a little warmer in the room this time. So we're here to give you kind of a two-part briefing. One is the final step in the North of Falcon policy process. The other is a response to a request that you guys made to us back in December. So today I'll walk through the draft policy as it stands today, give you an update on the public process and comment we've received over the past month or so. And then we'll give you a presentation that was what you requested in December on the application of government transparency laws to fisheries management negotiations at North of Falcon. That'll be sort of a multi-part presentation walking through some of the applicable laws and some of the efforts we've made in the past to increase transparency, and then you will be considering adoption of a revised policy. So a little background on the draft policy. We provided you a draft back in December that had some updates to the previous policy. Most of those were just sort of housekeeping changes. It did incorporate some public comment from the November meeting on the in-season management section. And the draft that we provided you today, which is on page 2 of your packet, is identical to the draft you saw in December. It's just had the changes accepted, so it's not marked up like it was back in December. So you did hear comments at both the November and December meetings on the policy. As I mentioned, the comment you heard on in-season management was incorporated into the draft. The other comments you heard centered around the communication section, specifically the transparency of our co-manager meetings during the North of Falcon process. After the December meeting, we posted the draft that you had reviewed to the web, requested comment through email after posting that online. We also informed all of our advisors through our meetings over the past month or so about the policy process and that draft was available for their comments. So focusing on the comments we did receive since we posted the draft, again, like the meetings, the majority of the comments focused on the transparency of co-manager meetings and the lack of public access to those meetings. I don't want to lose track of the other comments that we did receive. There were some general comments about the allocation of catch between tribal, non-tribal commercial and recreational fisheries. There were a couple of comments aimed at game fish seasons and the desire to keep those seasons separate from the North of Falcon process. With the coho situation last year, we had some closures that affected not just salmon, but essentially closed all fishing, including game fish and certain times and places. So there were comments asking us to avoid that. And there was a specific comment regarding language in the current policy on how to access, what to do with unutilized shares of catch. And that comment was saying that we should give consideration to allowing some or all of the unutilized portions of allocations involving ESA-listed stocks to go to spawning escapement. Since a lot of the comments did focus on what I'm calling the communication section of the policy and transparency, I thought it made sense to just put what the existing language is up there for you to see. And this is on page 4 of the draft policy, which is page 5 of your packet. And this language has been modified a little over the years, but it sort of gives the department guidance on how to increase transparency, how to involve the public. It says that we'll strive to make ongoing improvements for effective public involvement during the North of Falcon planning process and annual salmon fishery implementation, incorporating the following intents. One is to try to include observers in our co-manager meetings where possible. Two is to record our decisions during the North of Falcon process in writing. Three is to use a variety of tools to effectively communicate to the public. And four is to specific guidance to consult with our stakeholders before we make any major decisions during the preseason planning process or in season. So we'll move now to the specific request you guys made in December on the application of government transparency laws to fisheries management negotiations, and I am going to pass it off to Bill Freymeyer to walk through some of the applicable laws.
Good morning, commissioners. Is that about right? Does that sound? So I'm going to look and talk. And it's nice to be here. Good morning, Director, Deputy Director. Like Kyle said, I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I'm in the group that provides legal advice to the department and the commission. I particularly come and provide legal advice to the commission. I wanted to start off, before I get into the specific laws, remind you that these laws I'm going to talk about set the floor. They set the minimum standards for things. Nothing prevents you from doing more if you can, and I think the department does a huge amount of more. Kyle and Ron have mentioned the term advisors in a number of cases. I mean, all the advisory groups that the department has created are more than required by the law. So I think the department does do a lot of outreach and a lot of stuff beyond the legal requirements that we're going to talk about. But I will talk about three particular acts that relate to transparency. The Open Public Meetings Act is the one I'm going to focus on the most. That's the one that applies to you, and we'll get into that in a minute. I'm going to touch briefly on the Administrative Procedure Act. There are some open government opportunities in that, and that apply to the North Falcon process. And then the Public Records Act is a different way addressing transparency and public outreach. So, let's see. I'm also going to talk just briefly about tribal laws. That was the question in the request, and so we'll touch on that at the very end. And so let's go to the next one. So the Open Public Meetings Act is in the Revised Code of Washington. It's a law passed by the legislature, and it's in the Revised Code of Washington. That's what RCW means, and it's in Chapter 4230. There are a number of statutes, but one that has been identified in some of the written materials you've received from members of the public is the legislative declaration, and it's the very first statute. And in my mind, it sets the vision that the legislature was trying to express in the Open Public Meetings Act. I am not sure that the legislative declaration is enforceable in a court of law, but it is the vision that the legislature was expressing both to the public and to the state agencies that the legislature created. So there are two paragraphs, and it identifies that all the state agencies, the public boards, commissions, councils, committees, departments, exist to aid the conduct of the people's business. So vision type statement. The second paragraph talks about the people not yielding the sovereignty to the agencies. The people want to keep track of what the agencies are doing on their behalf. So that's really important, great language, setting the vision. So the Act has three or four pages of statutes, and the rest of the statutes are sort of where the rubber hits the road in the Open Public Meetings Act. And to me, the most important one is the next one. And so this is RCW 42.30.030. This is where the legislature, I think, has directed an agency to do. This is where they have taken effect. This isn't vision language. This is enforceable language. And what this one says is, all meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency except as otherwise provided in this chapter. And so we'll talk about the exception real briefly later, but this is where they turned the vision into action. And so in order to figure out, well, okay, what does this mean? Who is this enforceable against? How does it work? I think, fortunately, the legislature has provided some definitions of some key terms. And so all meetings of a governing body of a public agency. So let's start with public agency. The legislature defined public agency. And I didn't take the entire definition of public agency, but I did take the definition that applies to the issues we're dealing with. So public agency means any state board, commission, committee, department, educational institution, other state agency created by or pursuant to statute other than the courts or the legislature. So the legislature exempted them from the process, but they certainly captured you. The Department of Fish and Wildlife is a department created by the legislature, created by statute. So the department is clearly a public agency in my mind. So that was one of the terms in the statute we looked at before. The other term, the next term that's important, is governing body. And the legislature defined governing body, this 4230020, this is a set of definitions. And I just used two because I think these are the most important ones. So governing body, and this first paragraph is the quote from the statute. The second paragraph is my language. But governing body means the multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy or rulemaking body of a public agency or any committee thereof, when the committee acts on behalf of the governing body, conducts hearings, or takes testimony or public comment. So the phrases in this to look at are multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy or rulemaking body. I think the legislature was distinguishing here multi-member boards from single-head executive entities. So there are lots of state agencies that do not have a commission or a committee at the head. They just have a single head. And if you remember before merger, there was the Department of Fisheries and the governor appointed the director. There was no, at least in the later years of Department of Fisheries, there was no commission over the Department of Fisheries. At the same time, there was the Department of Game, later the Department of Wildlife. It did have a commission. So I think the legislature, when it passed the Open Public Meetings Act, in this phrase, distinguished between those bodies, those government entities that are led by multi-member entities, and created this law, and by this definition, focused this law on those entities that have statutorily created multi-member boards, and distinguished that from those entities that have single-head executives. And that's what I sort of flagged in the last paragraph. So let's go to the next one. This is the exact statute I started with. This is the one where the legislature makes effective the Open Public Meetings Act. And this is the quotation again from the thing, but I highlighted governing body. So all meetings of the governing body of a public agency. Well, public agency in this case is the Department of Fish and Wildlife. But only, in my mind, what I think this means is only those meetings of the governing body of the Department of the Fish and Wildlife shall be open and public, and all persons be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body. So again, this law is setting the floor. Nothing prevents the department from doing more wherever it can, and I think it has. But in this case, I think the legislature, by the use of governing body here, and as it's used throughout the rest of the Open Public Meetings Act, has signaled that it means this obligation applies to you, but it does not apply in the case of a single head director. So let's go on to the next one. So there are a number of other provisions, but that, to me, was for the purposes of this discussion, that was really the key phrase and the key sort of answer to how does this apply. As you know, the Open Public Meetings Act requires notices so that the public can know when your meetings are going to occur. This Open Public Meetings Act, it applies to all, you remember we talked about public agency, it applies to all forms of government or state agencies that have statutorily created multi-member bodies. So it requires notices so the public can know when you're meeting. It requires that minutes be taken. There's a little really short statute that's in a different place that requires minutes so that the public can keep track of what you do. There was that phrase that said your meetings are to be open except in certain circumstances as provided by law. There is a section that provides for certain executive sessions. They're to be narrowly construed, and I think you do that All agencies have to do that. When courts look at challenges to an executive session, they start back with the legislative declaration. That's usually the first paragraph in court opinions, very powerful language. And then they look to the executive session and say, it's to be narrowly construed. Did you meet that standard or not? This law provides for, it says that if you do not do the things that are required, if you're a governing body and you do not provide the notice, or you do not meet in public, or you do an executive session improperly, that's a violation, your actions could be null and void, and there are certain personal penalties that could attach to that. And the last thing in the discussion here, this law was created by your Washington legislature. It does not apply to treaty tribes. It does not apply to federal agencies. Whether the Washington legislature has jurisdiction over them, you know, is a question for another day, but it does not reach to them through this act.
Just to be really clear, you said statutorily created multi-person bodies, right? So in other words, if a public agency creates an advisory committee that is not required by statute, that does not fall under the Open Public Meetings Act?
Yeah, let's go back to public agency. Yeah, so public agency, so there are some more definitions that might apply in other contexts. I just captured this one so it would be most simple and most direct. But it is any state board, commission, committee, department, education institution, or other state agency which is created by or pursuant to statutes. So if, let's say a group of department staffers get together and create let's make the new license plate design drawings. If they're not created by statute, you know, and they're not, then I think there's a good argument that they might not be, they might not have to comply with this law. So if there's a particular, we can talk more about it, you know, if there's a particular one you're interested in, it may be that the other definitions help answer the question you have. I just did this one because it was sort of focused on what I was trying to get at with North Falcon, so mm-hmm. and you particularly. So happy to talk more about it. Okay, so so that was sort of my explanation of the Open Public Meetings Act. If there's another question about that, I'm happy to answer it. Otherwise, I'd go on and talk about three cases that have talked about the Open Public Meetings Act. The first two have talked about the Open Public Meetings Act briefly in the context of either prior iterations of this agency, well, in both cases. In U.S. v. Oregon, this was a federal district court case. This was a case in which, as you remember, U.S. v. Oregon is similar to U.S. v. Washington. Treaties mean in the context of fishing, basically, to put it really quickly. So back in 1988, all the parties that were involved in U.S. v. Oregon, this is, at the time, it was the State Department of Game, State Department of Fisheries, Oregon, I think it was just ODFW at that time. I don't know that they were split. But it was all the managers were coming to a management plan, and there were some parties that were upset about the management plan, and they sued in federal court. And so it was not the main parties that sued. It was some parties that filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, that raised the Open Public Meetings Act issue. And they said that the state agencies from Washington, the Department of Fisheries staff, so it was staff that had been down there. I wasn't there, but I believe it was staff that were doing the negotiation. And at that time, it was the director of fisheries, and Game had a commission who appointed the director, and the staff were down there. So these two parties, through amicus briefs, raised the issue, and the district court judge said, first, there was no evidence that the governing body, as defined by the Open Public Meetings Act, was at these meetings and participating. So he didn't find an Open Public Meetings Act violation there. He found that it was staff doing the work. There wasn't a huge lot, an amount of analysis in this case. It was pretty brief. It was raised by amicus parties. The judge went on to say the meetings of the, I think it's Technical Advisory Committee, PAC is the Production Advisory Committee, and this Policy Committee, they had broken up into groups to get this plan done. They were all advisory, and that each state, in order to set fishing seasons, do things that affected people, had to go back and go through whatever processes they had to go through, so that the things down here were advisory. And based on those two things, the judge found there was no violation of the Open Public Meetings Act, so denied those people.
Bill?
Yeah.
So to look at a parallel with North of Falcon then, do you know whether or not at that time the Game Commission would delegate to the director? I mean, could this have been a Game Commission responsibility that was delegated?
You know, I don't know. It is not reflected in the case. There's pretty short paragraphs. I wasn't a party to this case. I wasn't there. We could go back and maybe find that stuff. I would be surprised whether the Game Commission had policies like you do now. But I don't know. So so that's something that could be looked into. But I don't. So this is a federal case that talked about the Washington State Open Public Meetings Act as it applies to your two predecessor agencies. So the next case is one that came a little bit later. It's called Salmon for All. This was a challenge to the director of fisheries. This was when it was fisheries, single head director, no overarching commission. The director of fisheries was attending negotiations through his staff with Oregon. This is the same Columbia River fishing, regime that we're doing now. And there was a challenge to his action, and the challengers argued that, well, when you meet with Oregon and when you meet with the tribes, you're creating groups, and therefore those are governing bodies. Again, the analysis isn't hugely detailed, but the court did find that the Open Public Meetings Act does not apply to a single head agency director. The Open Public Meetings Act did not apply to the compact, even though there were multiple parties working together, and so it looked like a group. And lastly, the Open Public Meetings Act did not apply to staff negotiations with other entities. So in the case of a single head director, this is a Washington State Supreme Court case. So we have, in the compact context, so pretty close. Not exactly close to the way the department is structured now, but at least some language directly on point about the application of the Open Public Meetings Act. So the third case I'm going to talk about is one that doesn't involve the department at all. The CAPR is a group. It's the Citizens Alliance for Citizens Alliance for Property Rights Legal Fund. So the San Juan County is a multi-member board. It's the county commission, and they had to update their Growth Management Act. They had to update the critical area ordinance in their Growth Management Act, and they had tried a couple different times and hadn't got it done. And so they started a new initiative to figure out what their critical area ordinance should be, and they tasked staff to do, or well, staff created a working group, and that working group contained some of the county council members. It did not contain a quorum of county council members, so more than a majority. It contained less than a majority. So, and this group was called the team. And so the team had all these working meetings, and And they eventually drafted a critical areas ordinance, and then it was passed by the county council, adopted, and went off. And groups were upset about it and sued challenging. One tool they challenged was the team, the staff, and this less than a quorum of commissioners working together. They did not comply with the Open Public Meetings Act all the time. They had meetings behind closed doors. There were some open meetings, I think, but not all of them were. So the challenge was that, well, those groups, because they included county council members, that drug the Open Public Meetings Act. That was the allegation. And what the court said was, well, the team didn't bring a quorum of the county council members. Also, the team was not a committee. And let's go back just briefly to the definition of governing body. So we didn't, this one. So when I talked about this, I talked about the first phrase, the multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy rulemaking bodies. And then the second part is, or any committee thereof, when the committee acts on behalf of the governing body. So in the second phrase, the legislature said, when you are a governing body, you're the multi-member body created by statute. So the Open Public Meetings Act applies to you when you meet as a group. The question might be, well, can you create a committee? And if you create a committee, does the Open Public Meetings Act automatically follow or not? And the legislature answered that question by the language it used in the second phrase. Or any committee you create, when the committee acts on behalf of the body, conducts hearings, or takes testimony or public comment. So the way we interpret that is, if you create a committee, and it could be two of you, it could even be you create a committee of people not of the commission. You create a committee. If you give them power to make a decision, your power to make a decision, then that's how we interpret acts on behalf of the governing body. If you delegate them authority, the Open Public Meetings Act follows them through that phrase. If they do not have authority to make a decision, then they can't act on behalf of the body. And so even though they may choose to follow the same requirements of the Open Public Meetings Act, or they may create their own public process, they are not bound to by the law. So that's how some committees do trigger the act, and some committees do not necessarily trigger the act. And you look at, are they acting on behalf? Do they have the power to act? And it's not necessarily it's not only a delegation in my mind. If a committee just started doing it, said, we're doing this on your behalf, and you didn't stop them, I think there's an argument that they could be. So that's, I think, the distinction on committees. So let's go back to... So they said... even though there were these members of the committee, and even though these folks did a lot of hard work on this critical areas ordinance, because they did not have delegated power from the county council, they had no authority to make any final decision. They were just doing the staff work to create alternatives and drafts and proposals, that they were not a committee that meets that definition under the governing body term. So they said not a committee, did not act on behalf, and so they said even though this group did a lot of work outside public meetings, it was not subject to. Now again, that's the floor. They could have done more, and they did do more, but they didn't have to by law. So those are the three cases I was going to talk about on the Open Public Meetings Act. Let's see what's next. So, briefly, the Administrative Procedures Act. The Administrative Procedures Act covers a number of different things, but as it applies to North of Falcon, rulemaking is the place I want to talk about, because what comes for the department to create obligations or opportunities that are enforceable, the way the department has to do that is through the Administrative Procedure Act, and that's done through the rulemaking process. So, So we look at, well, who does it apply to? So the Administrative Procedures Act applies to state agencies, boards, commissions, education institutions. Again, the legislature exempted itself in the judicial branch, so you have to comply with it. The department complies with it. In the context of transparency and open government, it's really the rulemaking part we're looking at, and so let's look at the next one. Clearly, you're an agency, so you have to comply with it. So rulemaking, excuse me, the way that the legislature has directed you be transparent through the rulemaking process is you have to provide notice of what your rulemaking opportunities are. We do that through the Washington Register. There are strict timelines that have to be complied with. You can always do more, but you have to meet these minimum standards. You have to propose a proposed rule for permanent rulemaking. There are emergency rules, which are a little different situation, but for the most part, your permanent rules start with the proposed rule, gets out for public notice. There has to be a written opportunity for comment. There has to be an oral public hearing for permanent rules. And then there is the process for adopting a rule. There are appeal procedures. So this is how the legislature has directed that there be transparent and public opportunity to see what you're doing. Again, in this one, the legislature did not include treaty tribes in the definition of agency. They did not include federal agencies. So our legislature has created a set of laws that apply to you. Excuse me. So the other one, I'm happy to answer questions about that. The other one I was going to touch on real briefly is public records. Public records is another opportunity for the agencies to be transparent as directed by the legislature. Legislature has created a number of definitions. Agency is an important one. And in this act, the legislature has reached out to include all state agencies and all local entities. So this applies to all forms of state agency government, down to fire districts, probably weed boards, things like that. So very broad reach. Let's go on and see. So what the Public Records Act requires is disclosure of public records. It defines very clearly what a public record is and then says, for the most part, except for very narrow exceptions, agencies are required to maintain public records. There is a system called the Record Retention System, which is run by the Secretary of State, which tells agencies to classify records according to a number of categories, and that they can destroy records after certain times depending on the category. Nothing prevents you from keeping your records longer, but you have to keep them at least as long as these retention statutes require. If you have a record and someone requests it, and then unless one of these narrow exemptions apply, agencies are obligated to provide those records to the public. Ron talked earlier about public records requests that he's received in the past about phishing processes. I think the department receives lots of public records on these issues and responds. It has a great team of people who are working to figure out what is the requester requesting, what records do the department have, and how can they produce them. There are appeal processes if people don't like the response they got from the department. If the department makes a mistake, there are penalties and violations. And again, this one, the legislature created this applying to state agencies. This one also applies to the local governments. It does not, by law, apply to the treaty tribes, and it does not apply to federal agencies. So those were the three laws that our legislature has created that apply to you, that apply to other state agencies similarly situated, that I think respond to your blue sheet request. The request also asked that we look a little bit at the tribal law systems, and I did that, and I guess before I do that, let me tell you two great sources of information. So more information about open government, particularly the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act, can be found at the Attorney General's website. That's what ATG is. And the Attorney General has a website, www.atg.wa.gov. And then if you type in open government, there's an open government page. And the Attorney General has created lots of training materials and lots of information about how these laws work and how to access them. There's training materials for government so that they can learn how to do their part. There's information for members of the public to access so they can figure out how these things work. They're always trying to improve these things to make it easier to understand what's going on, what your opportunities are. Another place is the Municipal Research and Services Center. This is a group that provides information to local governments, counties and cities, and the other forms of local government. They have a website. If you type in Municipal Research and Services Center, and if you type in open government, you'll find they have lots of materials. They provide training for local governments. They also answer some citizen information requests, stuff like that. All of this is open to the public, very user-friendly in both cases. So now the next one is what I did to look at the tribal systems. Kyle can remind me if we need to. There are a bunch of treaty tribes that come to the North of Falcon process, and they are all individual sovereign governments. It's not one tribal government on the other side. It's 20. All individual. Like our Washington legislature creates laws for you, those 20 governments create laws for their own systems. So they create their laws, they create their own regulatory schemes. They have, most of them, I didn't look at all 20, I looked at 7 or 8, I think, just the websites. And usually you can find laws or legal systems or regulations, and I looked at that and found that most the ones I looked at usually have a process in their lawmaking and rulemaking procedures where they take public comment in one form or another. I've never done it, but I saw there was some opportunity. I did not find, in any case, a similar thing that looked like our Open Public Meeting Act law. And I did not find something that looks like our public records law. In my experience, I've never heard of that, you know, from any of them. I've never run into that. So their systems, you know, may not have chosen, like our legislature did, to do this. So that's sort of the lay of the land as I'm responding to your request. I'm happy to answer questions about it.
Thank you. So, in the North of Falcon process, where, as I understand it, this commission delegates authority to our director of a department to work with the tribes to come to negotiations, it seems to me if the tribes require secrecy, it's not for us to say you can't have secrecy, tribes. That's their decision. It's our decision to enter into that world. And if we do you feel that then we are on solid ground based on the only other option is to not negotiate, and we've kind of seen where that leads, and I don't think anybody in the public wants that either, because that can, you know, close all seasons down. So I guess what I'm trying to get to is a simple answer is, you know, I feel we are on solid ground because the alternative is to not have any negotiations. Is that correct?
Yes, like I started with, I mean, I think you can try to do more than the legal systems require, but I think that the way the department is staffing these negotiations is consistent with the minimum standards of the law.
Thank you.
Yes. guess I see the difficulty here. We have a commission-directed department now, and the commission is obviously governed by open public meetings, but we delegate to the director. So that it's now the director making the decisions. So does that mean that the finding, the decision of the 1992 case still is likely to be applied? The same rationale would be applied if it were brought to court again, that since we have delegated this negotiation for practical reasons to the director, now it's in the hands of a sole director, and therefore Open Public Meetings Act would not be required?
I think it is a couple of different thoughts. In the policy, you are delegating some authority to the director. That's clear. The director, through the statutes in Title 77, has some of his own independent authorities. There are certain things in Title 77 that says the director shall do this, the director shall do that. There are other statutes that say the department shall do this, and there are a number of statutes that say the commission shall do this. And so I'm not sure all the things that the director and the staff do out of the North of Falcon process. If there were some things that were solely based on statutes that said the director shall do this, then that to me would be most like the Salmon for All situation, in which the director is using director authority. If there were actions that the director were taking that we looked at the statutes and we started with the commission shall do this, and then you had delegated to the director, and that's completely appropriate. There is not, none of these three cases directly deal with that. But I think you would look to the term governing body and see, is the director a governing body? We don't have a court case answer for that. But my sense is that looking at the rest of the Open Public Meetings Act and its focus on multi-member boards and commissions, and then those committees, you know, and the way they structured committees, that only those committees that either are a quorum would bring the act, or when they have power to take final action in your name, I think that would support the idea that the act would not apply to the director in a single head director when you delegated authority to him.
Yeah. And I just want to follow up, I can certainly see the practical difficulties of trying to envision the commission engaging directly in negotiations with the tribes. That's hard to picture. We're a body that gets together no more than once a month, usually. So I understand that difficulty. On the other hand, we don't want government to grind to a halt. Decisions need to be made. Our delegation is pretty far-reaching. It's a document that we review every now and then. So the delegation function is very important to the operation of the department, no doubt. I guess I have to question whether we can make a distinction in North of Falcon, because it does involve some decision making that is not within our ever was brought to the commission. The decisions are made during the negotiations, and we adopt those decisions, or the department adopts those decisions through emergency rule, which is a process that doesn't involve the full measure of notice and explanation and comment by the public. And we certainly want to protect our ability to have this system function. We need to make these agreements. So we don't want to grind government to a halt. But I just wonder if there might be some way, and that's why I asked the question, where we can bring maybe some transparency after the fact, greater explanation for what happened during the negotiation, so that there is a fuller process rather than just the emergency rule adoption that sort of is seen by the public as ratifying what took place and involves the commission.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Wecker, I think I'll answer some of that during the rest of the presentation and what we've done to address transparency. The rules aren't adopted by emergency rule. There's a small portion that is to cover the time from when the process ends till the permanent rulemaking process can end, but I'll get into some of that as I finish up the presentation.
Thank you. I just wanted to back up what Commissioner Wecker said. Going into negotiations with a commission of nine people would be outlandish and could not be done, and that's why we have authorized the director to carry that forward. I also want to make clear that to the public here, it is not this commission or I believe the director's wish at all to have closed-door sessions. I don't believe this is you against us. It's just us trying to react to, in the best way possible, requirements of a sovereign nation. That sovereign nation, if they request closed sessions, and if we want to be a part of it, we have to make a decision at that point, be a part of it or not. I'm sure we would much rather have everything out in the front of the public. I just want to make that clear.
So moving on and trying to address some of the other parts of the request the commission made in December, you asked for some background on past efforts on improving transparency. In the previous policy was direction to try to get observers attendance at applicable state tribal meetings. That's something we have tried every year. We had some success in the past. There were years where we had observers in the meetings representing the public. We had rules, ground rules with the tribes on how that would work, and it seemed to work as well as it could. The tribes have not allowed that in the past several years. We have still tried, but they have chosen to not allow observers in the meetings. We have an extensive public meeting schedule that goes well beyond the APA requirements. I'll show you what our 2016 public meeting schedule looked like in just a second. We provide multiple opportunities and methods for the public to comment throughout the process, and update the public throughout the process on how things have changed, where negotiations are. And you've given us specific direction in the past to consult with our constituents before making major decisions, and I think we've done that as well. So just the 2016 example, this is sort of the major public meeting schedule. We had nearly 20 meetings around the state. They're state tribal meeting space throughout these, so part of the process is us bringing people up to date on where negotiations are with the tribes. I don't think any member of the staff or the public attends every one of these, but we're doing a lot of work around the state as we move through the spring.
And could you go back to that? So, Kyle, when is the decision made? What time frame?
There are a ton of decisions made along the way, but all of the final decisions typically happen as all of the fisheries come together at the Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting.
The last
in
one.
April, right?
And I think my point that I raised is I can see that you have voluminous meetings, and I think by the time the decisions are made, everybody's pretty exhausted. people have been meeting to death and driving all over the place. And I know that the negotiations context changes over time, so people feel like the target's always moving from meeting to meeting. Gets confusing. And when the decisions are actually made, then after that, do you have explanatory sessions, is my question.
And that's somewhere where we could improve, and I'll speak to it a little more in a further slide, but okay. That last week is pretty frantic.
And you're exhausted.
And we're all exhausted.
It's incredible pressure cooker, starting from
now.
When I was there, early in the morning till late at night.
So in addition to all those public meetings, we have conference calls and meetings with our advisors throughout the year. A lot of those are getting ready for the following year's process, getting early input, trying to keep them informed of where things are even before the process starts. We take public input by a variety of methods, mail, email, phone, online form comments throughout the process. And we're really communicating and consulting with the stakeholders throughout. Commissioner Wecker mentioned the April meeting. In those April meetings, we're meeting with the people that can be there or the people that can be on the phone in the morning, in the evening, and a lot of times in between those, trying to keep them up to date on the status of the negotiations, when tribal positions have changed, when we need to change in strategy, trying to engage everyone so that they know what we're doing and why we're doing it. Yes, it is a commitment for the people that track through that process, even if it is just being on the phone in those last days, but we're making the effort to communicate and take input that affects the decisions that get made. And all of this is in addition to the APA process that Bill spoke to, the rulemaking notices, written comment periods, and rulemaking hearings. We have those to follow that law, but we also have this giant process that goes on parallel to that. The last thing you asked for was recommendations for improving transparency. I don't know that I have any great ones other than to continue the efforts to get some level of public access to the meetings. Observers is one that we have been successful with in the past, but we've heard other ideas and we'll pursue those. But as a couple of you said, it's ultimately the tribes are sovereign governments, and if we need to work with them and get some agreement on how to allow the public access. And we remain open to other ideas for improving transparency. The phone calls, the advisor meetings throughout the process might not be enough for some people, but I'm not sure what else we do, what else we can do, but again, we're willing to listen to suggestions. Just to recap the process we've been through over the past couple months, you got an initial briefing on the policy back in November. You received the draft in December, which we put out for public comment after some guidance from you. We posted that online for public comment, which you heard about today. And here we are in January with consideration of a revised policy by the commission. And I can try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kyle. Difficult issue. Questions from the commission that haven't been addressed yet?
So we're going to make a decision on this policy. So before that, I'd just like to have a bit of a conversation about what more, as Bill has informed us, we can always try to do more, use our minimums in the law. And in the past several years, Commissioner Mencken and Carpenter have attended North of Falcon. They've been present during some of these sessions in which, and also Commissioner Kehoe has been there.
And Grayville.
So we do have a lot of interest on the commission in seeing what's happening, seeing how our authority is being pursued. And I think that the tribes have been accepting of commissioners being in these meetings. I guess Commissioner Mencken wants.
If I might. Yeah. No, the tribes do not like to have the commission members in the meeting room, but because we are technically employees of the department, they cannot exclude us from the meetings. I have been at a number of North of Falcon meetings, and I must say that I think that the department does a yeoman's job when it comes to maintaining the rules and regulations that we've heard today. The director is involved when the meetings are taking place. The public cannot be in there, but they come out of the room and there's a debriefing session that occurs. There's a briefing session that occurs frequently prior to entry into the discussion with the tribes. I have thought long and hard about the transparency issues associated with North of Falcon. It's extremely difficult for me to come up with new ideas, and I think Kyle has pointed that out. I know that the other commissioners are very frustrated by not being able to have observers in the room. They're not authorized by the tribes. I just frankly do not know what more we can do to solve the issue of transparency.
Last year was my first rodeo with North of Falcon, and I have to say that I was very impressed with the briefings prior to going into sessions with the tribes, what we were trying to accomplish, and explaining that to the stakeholders. There were many different organizations, groups, and associations represented in the room, the big room that we all met in, both prior to meeting with the tribes and then after. And yesterday at our Fish Committee meeting, I complimented Ron Warren for his ability to explain what just happened. And I also mentioned that the director listened closely, as did the commission members and staff, to the reaction from those stakeholder groups. To their input was very important in the process, and it was visible, either by phone or by the many groups and organizations that took the time to be there through the whole process. That was very important for the decision-making. They provided guidance for us. And that process, I was very pleased to the level of communication we had between stakeholder groups and private individuals during the process of North of Falcon. I concur with Conrad Mankin's comments that we're fortunate that commission members are still allowed into that room. And I believe that we are meeting the obligations that are required to us by the state, and very frustrated that we cannot move past that with the tribes. And I doubt very sincerely that we'll make any more progress this year.
One of the most difficult portions or processes of North of Falcon is in the main meetings when we're all in the room. There may be 10 or 15 people from the state there, and there might be 100 people there from the various tribes. And there's an old adage that I found that I think applies to the difficulty of negotiating with that many people in the room, and it reads like this. The success of a negotiation declines logarithmically by the number of negotiators in the room. And that, I think, is absolutely true in this case. It's extremely difficult to carry out negotiations with that many people in the room. And then follow-up meetings where you have to meet individually with individual tribes, that takes place during the North of Falcon process as well. So it's not an easy situation. I would say that the process is broken, but it's been broken for a long time, and I just don't see how we can get out of it at this point.
Well, this is it's a good conversation to have, because I know that there's a lot of frustration out there. And again, going back to what I started to talk about, that we have had a lot of interest among individual commissioners in attending and seeing what's happening, and I think that that's valuable to continue. And the reason is that in talking with people who are here and interested in this topic, pushing the idea of greater transparency, it's pretty obvious that there's a great deal of distrust. As I mentioned before, distrust of government is kind of widespread across the country right now. And there's a feeling by some of our stakeholders, some very vocal stakeholders, that we're not doing a good enough job informing them of the real choices that are in front of us and why we make the choices that we do. So I would just suggest that there may be some new thinking that we can do in relation to what the commission can bring to this, or individual commissioners in attending North of Falcon, in reporting back in open session what they saw, you know, what issues what improvements must be made. So in that way, you know, have a very frank and open, transparent discussion in open session about what we encountered and why we made the trade-offs that we did. So that could be, you know, the only thing. I know it's hard to come up with new thinking, but that was what occurred to me, that transparency can be improved, expanded in that post-negotiation phase, because that's just the interim for the next phase. The next negotiation is just down around the corner, so why don't we just have this frank conversation about why we made the trade-offs? And then I think possibly this distrust, this feeling of secrecy, and maybe the feeling that the rumors are mischaracterizations. Staff, I've heard, have their own sensitivities about the mistrust that the public has towards us, just as the public has distrust of what staff's motivations are. So I think there's room for building better communications after negotiations have been concluded, which would involve the commission using its credibility, its honesty, its role as voices of the public.
I personally have been attending the North of Falcon meetings for 20-odd years, as a stakeholder for many years and as a commissioner for 5 years. And the relationships and the working understandings between the state and the tribe have changed over the years in some different periods. And I can say from my perspective personally that when observers were allowed in the rooms with the tribes, it, in my view, it went a long way towards building trust and building relationships. I know I was in there. I think Mr. Kehoe was in there for some years, and other folks from the private sector were in. And you know, the rules were you didn't talk unless they asked you questions, the tribes and things like that, and that was all fine. But you got to know the people. When there was a break, you know, you got to know someone from the Nisqually tribe, or you talked to someone from the Lummi tribe. And over the years, I personally have built some reasonably good working relationships with a lot of these people, and to this day, I'm able to communicate with them, and them with me, and I think it's been very, very helpful. So I hope that the tribes will reconsider that, because I think it improves greatly opportunity for working relationship, better understanding, and maybe more readily solutions to problems. The last part of my comment is I hope that three or four commissioners, up to four we can have, will participate in these processes. I think it's important for the commission to be there and support the staff, the director and staff. I think it's brutally important to be there, be a sounding board, contribute where possible, and learn the process, try and influence the outcome in a positive way for our constituents. So I think that's really important. The one thing that didn't get talked about is the time frame. Kyle was kind enough to put all the meeting dates up there. But if you look at that last week in the second week in April every year, that's when the clock runs out. That's when the PFMC meeting takes place. And that's when it's a federal meeting for all intents and purposes. And by the Wednesday of that week, there has to be a deal done. And so we come up against a time crunch. I don't know how to overcome that, but that issue in itself causes a lot of angst among people because the clock is running out. You're trying to reach agreement. It's 2:00 in the morning. I don't know how to change that, but some discussion about that I think would be healthy in the future.
Thing. I expected Commissioner Carpenter and Mankin to make this point, but since they didn't really hammer it home, I think we need to mention that we have made efforts to foster more regular communications with the sports leadership and organized sports leadership, and there has been a degree of frustration on our side as far as the complaints being lodged by people who are not willing to put in the time and effort to attend. You've made this point a number of times, so has Commissioner Mankin. We need this activism to continue by these stakeholders, and we need you to attend North of Falcon. Be present. Don't let us all off the hook. Just be aware that we're not seeing that many people attending North of Falcon now, just if the leadership of a few sport organizations. And frankly, sport organizations and sportsmen need to become more organized. You need to strengthen your voice so that we have, you know, one voice to work with. Because we're hearing very different things, and a lot of people don't show up, and so there's a responsibility on that side.
Yeah. Good point.
I perhaps was remiss, but I think I've probably said to stakeholders over the years relating to North of Falcon that if you're not at the table, don't complain about the outcome. The people that complain more about the outcome and the positions that we end up finding ourselves in haven't attended the meetings. And I know that's frustrating, and in some cases it costs money, but knowing more about the process and what happened and how the timeline works is still a positive thing to know. So I would encourage people to get involved.
Okay. Very good point. Yeah,
I see participants from the recreational fishing community in the audience today, and some of them have showed up, and Andy is one good example right there. He has showed up religiously for the last, at least the last North of Falcon process. And so I think we're getting that kind of participation that we need, but we definitely need the leadership of the recreational fishing community and the commercial fishing communities to show up at these meetings.
I think that good discussion by all, good points raised. Again, very complicated, difficult issue to address. And very frustrating for us on the commission, just so everybody knows in the audience that it's we share your frustrations. With that, I'm looking for a motion.
Mr. Director, I move to adopt the North of Falcon policy number C-3608 as presented by staff.
And I second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.